Today, Chaos City. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analysis. It's one of his posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined for my Friday chat with Tarek Brooker, journalist. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. A week is a long time in politics, huh?
Oh, a week, a couple of hours is a long time. Long time in politics at the moment, mate.
Yeah, the whole context, of course, is being framed by the US election. I spoke to Salvador Babón yesterday, who made the point that this is quite typical for the US election process. It was just grinding forward, and this is, you know, don't panic, just sit there, enjoy the ride. But I have to say, the ride is pretty uncomfortable for those watching.
Oh, it's more than a little bit bumpy, I can imagine. You know, like, you know, people, Americans went to bed on Tuesday night thinking that all was lost and, you know, Trump was going to be president all over again. I mean, he said as much to the American people. And then they woke up on Wednesday morning and all of a sudden Biden was in the driver's seat. And there's quite a few angry people out there.
Yeah. And what I find interesting is the relatively entrenched positions, if you like, of the two sides of politics in the US. And I wonder whether that really is a bit of a cartoon as to what's really going on. I wonder whether the real truth is there are many more, fragmented power elements jockeying position and, you know, different perspectives, rather than just seeing it as a big polar set of opposites.
Yeah, well, it's really quite interesting. Like, when you sort of get down to the nitty gritty in terms of like the different ideological positions of the parties and, you know, the way they view things, it's increasingly different. You know, on one hand, at the left of the Democrats, you've got people who are basically, I mean, they call themselves democratic socialists, but they press for things that would make the Greens blush. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got the people who don't really, you know, sort of like the Tea Party end of the spectrum, you know, sort of very much, you know, Tea Party does stand for taxed enough already, for anyone who doesn't know that. So, you know, they're very much sort of like fiscal conservatives, and, you know, there's all these various different competing factions all vying for their ideological supremacy.
Yes. And I wonder whether the, that sort of polarization is also matched by the electorate, or whether in fact the electorate is, you know, just sort of all over the place at the moment, because it seems to me that reading some of the commentary, you know, some of the migrant groups that they thought were going to behave one way behaved in another way, and other people seem to be doing different things. So it's like, I'm not sure anybody really quite knows what's going on.
No, and I think that a lot of the various narratives have been sort of constructed around these ideas that really aren't true, that we've seen, you know, say, for example, like, you know, people have said, oh, Trump's racist, no one's going to vote for Trump, you know, no minority groups are going to vote for Trump. And that wasn't true. He had the highest share of the minority vote in years for a Republican. So, and it's also, they boil it down to this red state, blue state thing. And I think that this election has really proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the whole, you know, this state's red, this state's blue is really a massive oversimplification of what's actually going on. Like, you look at a state like Georgia, you know, that's going absolutely down to the wire, down to a couple of thousand votes potentially deciding the outcome. And, you know, traditionally it's viewed as a very, very red state, but because of internal migration, that's changed. But when you actually look at a map of Georgia, the overwhelming majority of it's red because it's country areas, which obviously have a lower population, and then the urban areas blue. So it's really emblematic, I think, of the sort of rural city divide, which has really become an ideological divide, even more so in recent years.
Yeah, that's very true. And, of course, the other observation is that there have been more votes cast this time than pretty much ever, right? So both sides are actually seeing bigger totals.
Yeah, and I think that's good for the process. It's good that, you know, more Americans are getting out there and getting engaged one way or another, even if it is, you know, sort of a little bit of a crusade on both sides, which is perhaps a little bit less positive than higher voter turnout. But I mean, I suppose it's just really just emblematic of what's going on around the world. It's not just America that's facing these issues with polarization and, you know, with you know, people disengaging from the political process and, you know, sort of going down the ideological rabbit hole on social media and that sort of thing, while America may be further along that particular road than the rest of us, I mean, I think we're all broadly speaking on it at some, you know, at obviously at varying, you know, varying depths down the road.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds as though a lot of other countries are going down the sort of the same trajectory. And I would argue that now social media has a role to play here. I'm interested that some of Trump's recent tweets have been flagged by Twitter as not necessarily being 100% accurate, which is pretty amazing, really.
It is. I mean, it's unprecedented for you know, a potentially outgoing president to be behaving in this manner. You know, if you look at people who have been defeated, you know, like, I mean, I've been watching some of the concession speeches today by, you know, people like, you know, John McCain, Mitt Romney, you know, going back as far as like, you know, George, you know, Bush Senior. And it's obviously very, very different tone to the one that Trump's taking. And in a lot of ways, that's what makes this all so concerning at the moment, because we don't know what the outcome is just yet. You know, I mean, obviously it's all well and good to say, okay, this is what's what, but, you know, we don't know how court challenges are going to play out. I mean, in all likelihood at this point, you'd have to say it's going to be Biden, if you know, gun to your head. But, you know, I mean, this is 2020, you know, crazy things happen. And we, you know, we don't really know how the chips are all going to fall just yet.
Mm. And of course, it's also worth observing, it looks as though the two houses will be effectively opposed against each other as well. So even if Biden does get in, his agenda is probably going to be somewhat clipped.
Yeah, and I think that really speaks to the sort of perception of the presidency, you know, especially that's really cropped up around Trump in recent years, you know, because of all his sort of overreaching executive orders and all that sort of thing. It's really been, you know, viewed as a sort of almost like a position of a minor king rather than, you know, the head of the executive branch. So I think that people are in for quite a reality check, the people who really thought that this would be, you know, the blue wave, the Green New Deal, the stimulus tax turned on to trillions forever and ever. I mean, if we do see the Republicans control the Senate, which is looking relatively likely, depending on whether or not some of these Georgia Senate seats go to a runoff or not, you know, it could just be political deadlock for the next 2 years, you know, and possibly longer.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we saw that a few years ago and, you know, not a lot was done. Although a bit more foreign policy might get done insofar that they can do that without needing to put it through the the Congress.
Well, that's probably one of the most interesting parts of all this, because, you know, if we are going to see less stimulus, much, much smaller stimulus than what was expected by the market and just generally expected. I mean, people were talking 1.5, 2.2 trillion. You know, Mitch McConnell, who's the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, he was talking 500, 750, you know, worlds apart. And if we end up closer to McConnell's number rather than Pelosi's or Biden's, it's going to be very, very different. But then there's the other side of the coin, as you say, with the foreign policy, because if Biden does end up a little bit more chummy with China, we could end up seeing some sort of, you know, economic dividend from that cooperation. And, you know, I mean, even, you know, sort of increased levels of trade between the US and elsewhere, because, you know, it hasn't just been China that Trump's been targeting. You know, there's been issues with Europe and other parts of Asia as well.
Well, that's true. But I think one thing that is being overlooked at the moment, Biden was very clear on the need to tackle the virus and get it under control. Now, the interesting question is, if he follows through on that, then presumably that means something like a lockdown or something similar to be able to sort of get it under control, which would suggest significant economic damage.
Yeah, I mean, that's Biden's position in a nutshell, isn't it? You know, he's very, very much, you know, we're going to shut down this virus. And realistically, given what's going on in Europe and the fact that, you know, America's heading for Thanksgiving, which, you know, some epidemiologists and experts are saying could be absolutely disastrous for case numbers in the US, you know, it could really drive some sort of a second round of painful lockdowns for America. And I think one thing that's important to keep in mind is, even though America's case numbers are the highest in the world and they're growing at the fastest rate in the world in nominal terms, in percentage terms, in terms of cases per capita, overall, they're still well behind a lot of Europe. And if you see US case numbers end up skyrocketing towards, you know, Belgium, or, you know, well, Belgium, I believe, is the worst at the moment. If you see case numbers in the US shoot up to Belgian levels, it's going to be disastrous for the economy, and it's going to be disastrous for the American people.
Exactly right. And, you know, I think that the markets, of course, have been very bullish over the last couple of days. And I'm not sure they're fully factoring in the potential lockdown or equivalent implications in terms of trying to get the virus under control. And in fact, if you look carefully at the markets, it's often being driven by the big tech stocks because they think under a Biden regime, they'll probably have less, clipped wings, as it were. Their taxes won't be going up probably as much as they perhaps thought they might in other circumstances. And essentially, some of those other competitive issues might actually not be there as well. Because my understanding is that the big techs and Biden's group is quite close together, really.
Well, I mean, I suppose you could certainly make that argument. I mean, it's, you know, without sort of commenting on it to the point where I get myself in trouble again, but you know, it is fairly clear that, you know, that there is a or at least in the past there was a bias towards the sort of right, you know, heavily right wing people like Alex Jones and him and his what does he say the vampire world order conspiracy theories and all that sort of stuff, you know. But what we've seen recently is it's really just silencing any sort of dissent, really. And it's quite unpleasant to watch, to be completely honest with you, because I wrote about this a couple of years ago and everyone thought I was a dickhead at the time. They're just like, oh, it's just Alex Jones, why do you care? And I said it sets the precedent, and now it's being used, you know, to silence people who have, you know what I mean, like, say for example, that Twitter banned the New York Post, you know, that, I mean, obviously it was only temporary, but you know, that's something that shouldn't be happening. And I mean, the way I see it is that social media is the modern day town square. And if you want to go out there and you want to rant and rave like a moron, as long as you're not doing anything illegal, you should be left alone. But unfortunately, that's not what's happening.
No, well, it means, of course, that they're becoming more and more editors. Now, a few years ago, of course, they all claimed that, no, we're not editors. We're not responsible for the content. We're only responsible for the platform. It's sort of, they've moved, haven't they?
Well, I suppose that's just a sign of the times. You know, we're increasingly seeing people involving themselves in politics that, to be completely frank, they probably shouldn't be. You know, they should be taking a more impartial sort of approach. But, you know, that's just the sort of polarization of society. I mean, I look at even what's going on at the moment in Spotify over Joe Rogan. You know, I mean, Joe Rogan is a guy who would have voted for Bernie Sanders. You know, he wants universal healthcare. You know, he wants to legalize marijuana. He wants to do all those sorts of things. He's a relatively left-wing guy by American standards, of course. But people are going after him like crazy. You know, they wanted to censor him. They're wanting to remove all these episodes that they find offensive. And I just don't really see the benefit of that sort of thing in a free society. If you don't want to watch it, don't watch it. You know, it's a free country.
Thin end of the wedge, isn't it? Because of course, the next step is who else do they actually censor or otherwise chop, and who's the they who's doing it, and what's the frame of reference they're operating within, and who's to say that they've got the right view rather than somebody else with a different view. So I agree with you. It should be open slather, you know, within the overall civil liberty rules, rather than actually trying to pick or choose particular storylines and particular people.
I to be honest, like, I mean, I when it all started with Alex Jones, all the people on the left, you know, a lot of people were celebrating. They were like, oh, this is fantastic, you know, we're going to get all these nut jobs off of social media, this is going to improve things, it's going to reduce polarization and all that sort of thing. And you know, now it's been turned into this sort of, you know, sort of tool of broader censorship. But I think, you know, and the point I made at the time was, this is who is wielding this particular weapon or this tool right now. You don't know who's going to be wielding it in the future. You know, you don't know who the next Facebook or the next Twitter or the next Instagram or whoever it is going to be. And if they're going to be politically and ideologically opposed to you, you know, if they're going to be, you know, heavily right-wing perhaps, you know, we just don't know. And I mean, to me, that sort of exacerbates the polarization even further. I mean, imagine for a moment if in a world in which Facebook is left and Twitter is heavily right, where both social, you know, where the largest social networks are both pushing two completely different agendas very aggressively into a society. I mean, it's a recipe for bad outcomes, you know, to what degree, you know. That's for, you know, sociologists and people who know more about this sort of stuff than I do.
Well, but it is important to understand how people make their decisions and how they're influenced. And of course, the social media platforms have demonstrated their ability to influence for good or for bad. So I think it's an important thing to underscore. Now, let's switch to Australia and the Reserve Bank. They published their statement on monetary policy today and basically said unemployment up to about 8%. Will be a bit lower in a couple of years, but they don't expect it to be back to where it was before the virus struck for several years. And they're also talking about growth being somewhat slower. So in a way, you can sort of understand why they cut the rates as they did. But on the other hand, you have to say, is it going to make much difference?
Well, part of me wonders if the rate cuts more and even the QE is even just part of the currency wars more than anything. Like you're seeing the Australian dollar pushing up towards 73 cents today, last time I checked.
And so that worked well then, didn't it?
Yeah. You know, well, I can just imagine, you know, low with the button, control P going nuts. And it's a bit ridiculous, really, because, you know, the sort of orthodox view of things says, you know, you're spending, you know, you're doing QE over the next 6 months, it's worth 5% of GDP, and you weren't doing that before. You know, perhaps that should, you know, drive down your currency, but that's not what's happening here. So, I mean, the dollar's really at the mercy of the you know, global markets, and, you know, this, as a risk on currency, it's just getting sort of, you know, dragged around with the tides of financial markets.
Well, that's absolutely right. And of course, the quantitative easing processes is creating more liquidity, which they're pumping into the banks to try and get the banks to lend more. But I do find it interesting that the money supply continues to go up whilst total credit growth continues to go down. And if you actually look at it, the reason is that confidence isn't particularly strong, particularly amongst the business community, particularly small businesses. So I'm not quite sure that just pumping in more liquidity, hoping that more people will borrow and that will get us out of the hole, is necessarily going to work. It hasn't worked for the last decade, so why would it work now?
Well, it's a bit concerning looking at some of the RBA's numbers, to be honest, because if you compare them with some of the recent data released by the ABS in terms of the payrolls, the RBA figures are already in tatters. You know, I mean, I know that the ABS figures are very fluid and they're experimental and, you know, disclaimers, etc. You know, terms and conditions may apply, but, you know, in the last two reports in the last 28 days, they've shown job losses of about 200,000. And that immediately followed the tapering of JobKeeper. Now, you know, let's sort of be conservative and say that's half true. I mean, you're already moving up towards peak unemployment of nearly 8% just based on that all by itself. You know, you throw in the actual, the tapering of JobKeeper again in January, and then the conclusion of JobKeeper in March and the end of the insolvency moratorium in January. And you just look at it and you go, how are we going to get unemployment to peak at 8% again? It just, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm missing a key piece of the puzzle here, but I sort of struggle to see how we're going to get 4 million, you know, roughly 4 million people off of JobKeeper with only 4% of them losing their jobs and no people losing their jobs when the insolvency moratorium ends.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of other data points. Roy Morgan came out with their latest unemployment at more than 12% and more than 22% underemployed or unemployed is the total number, which means that it's still more than one-fifth of everybody working. And they also made the point that the people looking for work has dropped, which is interesting. So that sort of doesn't point in the right directions. And the other observation is that in my SME surveys, I'm still seeing more SMEs saying we're unlikely to maintain our current ability to trade. And I was talking earlier on today with somebody who works in the insolvency area, and he says he's so quiet. There are no insolvencies at the moment, right? And of course, the reason for that is the moratorium until the end of the year. But then, of course, what happens after that? When I said, well, looking at my data, I think you might have a busier 2021.
Yeah, well, I certainly think so. I mean, you know, whether you sort of look at even at your data, if you say, you know, 80% of them are being pessimistic, even if you say 80% of them are being pessimistic and they're wrong and that things are going to bounce back and that they're just being, you know, doomsayers or whatever. I mean, based on the last numbers I saw from you, that's still something like, what, about 5% of all businesses?
Yep.
Broadly speaking?
Yep. And interestingly, it tends to be down in the sort of the smaller end of the SMEs. In other words, the large firms are doing a lot better. It's those middle and smaller firms that are actually the ones really up against it. And they're, you know, in retail, and they're in hospitality, and they're in education and tourism, you know, all the obvious ones. Plus some tradies. So it's interesting that, you know, whilst there may be a bit of a boom because of, you know, the government schemes to be able to actually start all of those new construction projects, it's not uniform across the country. There are a number of areas where it's just not really happening at all. So I think there's a really interesting question here as to how this all plays. So remember, of course, more stimulus is being removed at the moment than the last quarter, and next quarter more stimulus is being removed again, and the budget was actually net negative rather than positive in terms of overall stimulus contribution. So I don't think that the economy is going to be able to stand up on two feet. And then, of course, we've got the China factor and the most recent hints that maybe some of those imports are being turned off now, so that you know, some of the agricultural products and even some of the mining products may not actually be able to go into China. That's another big deal.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm pretty sure the Australian put the number of total affected exports around about $149 billion. I believe the number was. Don't quote me on that. That's just off the top of my head. But it's a lot. You know, it's a big, big hit. And it's interesting because we painted ourselves into a corner. Now, people can attack Scott Morrison for what's gone on, for the way that, you know, we've been sort of, you know, lockstep with the US in recent months, especially since the virus hit. But at the end of the day, what's going on now isn't solely Morrison's fault. This is something that's been brewing for well over a decade. You know, this is, you know, probably 15 years of short-sighted policy, betting the farm on China and thinking that we didn't have to choose. Now that Biden, you know, is likely to become president, maybe we won't for a little while longer until someone more hawkish returns to the White House. But it's definitely something that we have to really sort of keep in mind, because, you know, who knows where, I mean, things could continue to deteriorate.
Well, it certainly calls out that we should be thinking about other markets and other places where we can do business rather than just banking on China all the time. You know, I think we're highly trade exposed. And if I was, you know, in the banking system as I used to be, I used to look at risk. And one of the issues I'd look at is something called concentration risk, which is basically to say how much of my total business is reliant on one type of customer or one customer, right? Well, concentration risk to China is massive for us. And that hasn't just happened overnight. That's built up over 20 or 30 years. I didn't see almost, I don't recall seeing anyone saying up till quite recently that this actually represented a risk.
Yeah. No, it was me and a few other people. You know, I mean, I remember writing about this a few, you know, I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago now.
Yep.
And people were just like, no, it's, you know, you're just being a doomsayer. You're just being a doomsayer. Everything's fine. It's been fine for the last 20 years. Why should this be any different? But, you know, that's not really the way the world works. And I think one of the key things that people need to remember is when it comes down to between geopolitics and economics, geopolitics nearly always wins out. It's about the, you know, the clash of the titans, and, you know, if a few industries get crushed in the process, then that's just the cost of doing business for you know, superpowers. And, you know, we're a minnow in all of this. You know, we're the grass while the elephants fight with each other, and we're the ones who get trampled.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we had all the bank results now that we're having at the moment. You know, NABs came out most recently, and it's the same old. So the top line in terms of profitability way down, thanks to higher provisions, thanks to lower income, thanks to remediation costs in their billions. As a result, dividends are actually lower. And it's interesting that all three of them are talking about cost control and trying to actually drive their, you know, their business harder, which basically signals people losing their jobs rather than anything else. And then going back to my concentration risk thing again, and of course they're still all talking about lending to houses being a critical part of their business going forward. I wonder whether we've learned anything from the last couple of years, actually.
No. I mean, I think the thing that we've learned is that they can get away with murder. You know, the Royal Commission report was watered down, you know, to basically, I won't say nothingness. Nothingness isn't quite fair, but, you know, to a fraction of what I think Kenneth Hayne probably would have liked, judging by the look on his face in that famous photo with Frydenberg. But, you know, I mean, I take that back. It's a little bit unfair. The banks have tried to be more prudent. That is absolutely true. They are acting more prudently than they were before. That is a fact. But I still think that at the end of the day, they've got, you know, the Politico housing complex behind them, you know, spurring them on, saying, you know, lend a bit more, lend a bit more, lend a bit more. And I'm not really sure how that's going to play out in the coming months and years, because if things get as challenging as we think they may, the banks aren't going to lend. They're not idiots, you know. And not only that, but I'm not sure if you saw in the US, they broke down the number of loans based on credit score. Now, if you're just average, you know, average Joe and Joanne, your loan growth has gone nowhere. It's basically been static since 2020 started. There's been very, very little uptick. So this whole narrative about, oh, people are taking, you know, everyone's taking advantage of low rates. Not in the US. That's bull. People are not taking advantage of low rates who are just regular average Joes. They're just worrying about getting through the day and keeping their job. But in terms of people who are more affluent, people who have those higher credit scores, people in the upper deciles of income and net worth, for them, it's skyrocketing. They're all going out, they're buying second and third homes and, you know, ditching the penthouse in New York and buying themselves a mansion in the Hamptons.
Yep, that's exactly right. Well, I think to an extent we're seeing something of a similar thing here, insofar that the top end of the market, and particularly some houses in some more exclusive areas, are actually quite strongly in demand, whereas, you know, in the rest of the suburbs and units, it's looking pretty negative. I'm sure you saw the ABC article today, which quoted myself amongst Steve Keen and Shane Oliver. I thought it was actually quite a good article in terms of trying to give a more rounded view of the current situation with regard to property and what's going on.
No, I enjoyed it. I retweeted out Nassim's article. I think it was a very, very solid piece for, you know, whether you're a bull or a bear, because it showed that there's risks. But, you know, it's like Shane Oliver said, it also comes with a pretty much government guarantee of rising housing prices. But just to your point on the affluent areas, I think it's very interesting that you hear people talking about the sort of headline CoreLogic index numbers, and they go, oh, look at Sydney, look at how much better it's doing, or look at how much better, you know, this place is doing, or that place, or whatever. And I just feel like saying to them, it's like, okay, well, let's just unpack that claim for a moment. On one hand, this article saying that CoreLogic's broader indice for a city is rising. Okay, let's say that's true. But then you look at the actual some of these other articles that say, oh, you know, prices in on this area, this part of the Northern Beaches, are up 10%, or they're up 15% in this affluent area. And then when you really unpack it and you just go, well, if prices are up this much in this affluent area and that affluent area, then the rest of the city must be declining. So really, that doesn't mean that housing prices in your area, if you just live in an average sort of, you know, average area that's not sort of super duper desirable at the moment, you know, maybe prices are falling in your area. You know, you just don't know, unfortunately. And unfortunately, as you've pointed out recently, we don't really have the transparency in some places to find out.
No. Well, of course, I always say averaging masks. And you're absolutely right. If you've got more top-end transactions that are going up, you know, that has quite a significant impact if there are low volumes of transactions elsewhere. And so there are a couple of moving parts. Firstly, what is the volume of throughput, right? The second is, what additional overlay assumptions are being made with regard to the hedonics, in other words, comparing, you know, like for like types of properties. That's, of course, very untransparent. And then the third is what happens when you actually get settlement data coming in, which is actually lower than the imputed value that was expected. You know, Edwin and I have been discussing this a few times, and quite often that settlement data doesn't need to get back into the underlying data, so you can end up with imputed values which are significantly higher than reality, and yet they flow into the index. So that's sort of the internal mechanics. But then your main point is dead right. You know, I still see people quoting the average uprise in price and say, well, that means my property's gone up by that amount. And of course the answer is no, not necessarily so at all. And in fact, you know, there's often many offsetting movements. So if you have big movements over here on the upside, you may well have other movements here on the downside. And generally, my analysis, as I said to Nassim when I gave her the input for her article, was that there is an oversupply of units. I think there's about 600,000 now people wanting to sell, right? So that basically says there's an oversupply of properties coming on. There's a slight undersupply of houses, particularly in those large lots, you know, the ones closer into the CBD, but it's very, very specific and concentrated. There's an oversupply of new and relatively new properties on the outskirts of towns, places like, I don't know, like Cranbourne and Narre Warren in Victoria, where effectively there's acres and acres and acres of stuff that has been built and is still being built. And the other interesting observation, which is something which I haven't really seen much people talk about, which I think should be talked about much more, is the subdivision. There's a lot of subdividing going on at the moment, and that's one way that people are actually creating value for their existing property by basically chopping it in half and selling off the land and then basically letting somebody else build on the one next door. And of course, the planning rules now in many parts of the country are now down to sort of 250, 300 squares block rather than 600 squares block, in some cases even lower than that. So you're seeing a whole bunch of subdivisions and new building, and those new buildings are adding to the stock in a market where the total stock is much higher than demand at the moment.
It really does make you think just about the whole balance of the thing, because it's interesting, because like you look at, say, like CBA, they've banned foreclosures until September next year. You know, I mean, that to me speaks of the sort of issues, and also the fact that the desire to you know, shall we say, engineer some confidence.
Well, because, you know, so just on that, whose interest is it to not do that, right? It's partly in their own interests.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Absolutely. That's what I mean. Because on one hand, it gives people longer to be able to just hope that some way, somehow things work out, and some way the government just, you know, throws enough money at the economy to keep it going and get these people paying their mortgages again. But on the other hand, it also creates a sense of confidence for people, because it's like, well, ScoMo saved us. Now the banks have offered us deferrals, and now they're not even kicking people out of their homes. So it sort of just adds to that sort of underlying bullishness for the property market, because people can go, oh, it's all right. No. The forced sales thing is never going to become a problem. But look what CBA did. They're just going to keep doing that forever and ever and ever until the economy gets better, and they're just never going to let anyone have to be forced to sell their home. Or maybe it's just going to be a trickle and it's not going to impact the market.
Well, you wonder what APRA is going to think about that, because, of course, they basically gave the principal and interest holiday repayment window out until March. So between March and September, CBA is saying we're not going to do anything. Now, the interesting observation is that generally, if you start a foreclosure process, the processes take somewhere between 6 months and 9 months to complete. So in fact, they're not giving you much at all. Right. If they were to start in March, you wouldn't actually be hit until later on in the year anyway.
Yeah, well, that doesn't sound like a good headline, Martin.
Sorry. you mean me being realistic rather than just headline grabbing? Sorry about that.
Oh, you're spooking the punters, mate. You know, that's not going to be good for your housing price terrorist reputation.
No, indeed. Well, I should probably dust that off and give it a bit of a polish, right? Because I still maintain we're in the foothills. I still maintain that with higher unemployment and all of the stimulus being removed and all of those things we've spoken about in terms of the small business sector, I think the next year is going to be much less positive for house prices than many people are suggesting. And all my analysis shows that we've got an oversupply of units, slight undersupply of houses. But the other interesting thing is that there's a sort of significant migration. So there's a lot of movement from Sydney and Melbourne in particular into other states around the country. So I also think we're going to see that as another factor in play. And whilst the virus might be being unlocked and therefore the borders are being unlocked, that might allow people to start moving more dramatically from one place to another place. And people, it seems as though Western Australia and Queensland might be a better place to go.
Oh, well, it certainly looks that way at the moment, doesn't it? I mean, you know, they both got the virus under control faster than we did in New South Wales and Victoria. And not only that, but it's usually a lot sunnier and nicer there than it is sometimes during the Sydney and Melbourne winters, relatively speaking.
Yeah, it's just in the rather humid and hot northern summers that, being an ex-Brit, I find that rather eroding.
Each to their own, you know. We all like different things, but it's just I'm just curious, just sort of how they see all this sort of playing out. Like I read these forecasts from the banks, and I just think, no, 8% unemployment. And I don't know. Sometimes I just wonder if I'm going mad, because I read all this stuff that's completely contrary to the math that I do, and I just go, is my understanding of math just crap? Or is there something else going on here? I mean, where do you see unemployment sort of heading in 2021 as it stands? Now, obviously, you know, that might change with government stimulus, and et cetera, but as government policy sits today.
Well, how are you measuring it? Are you measuring it on the
ABS numbers?
Okay, all right. Yeah, so my view is that I think the 8 to 8.5 is going to be exceeded. I think that we'll probably see it tick over to the 9+, probably in the first quarter of next year. I then think it will sort of wander sideways, but it won't really come down for probably 2 or 3 years, because I don't think that the strategies that have been put in place by the government will be sufficient to really turn the ship around, as it were. There are too many businesses that are actually in difficulty. Household finances are going to be shot for quite some time. No wages growth. I don't see where wages growth is going to come from. And there's a small issue, of course, as well, as to whether the superannuation contributions is likely to go up or not. I don't know whether you saw the FOI from the RBA, but there's actually two of them where the RBA was modelling the impact of increased super and basically saying, well, that'll be another downward draft on wages growth. So wages growth, you can pretty much forget that. We know the cost of living are continuing to go very strong in a number of areas, and I think that will continue. So that's going to put more pressure on households. And I think the other interesting thing, if you look at the mix of employment, there's more and more evidence that the jobs that are coming back are part-time work, fragmented rather than full-time jobs. So if you put all that together, then I think you've got to assume that over the next 2 to 3 years, unemployment's going to be particularly problematic. Won't be uniform across the country, won't be uniform across the age groups. I think many younger people will be having great difficulty, but also people over sort of 50 to 55 plus, and many of those will suddenly find that they are out of work. Evidence from the global financial crisis showed that a lot of people then tried to start their own businesses, you know, 50 plus, using some of the skills that they had used in a bigger context. And that then fell over after 12, 18 months, 24 months, because it's really hard actually to run your own business unless you've got some particular captive audience to sell to. So that's all going to play through. And then I don't see how the international context, with the virus still raging around the world, and particularly in the Northern Hemisphere and in the US, is going to actually allow us to do much in terms of opening the international borders. So that's another factor there. So yeah, I'm probably relatively negative, but I'm with you. I see all this stuff, and in fact, I put all this information in my core model and turn the handle and see what happens. And I think, gee, well, if that's right, you know. So unless my model is not adequately taking account of yet more funny things the government will do, the unnatural acts that they keep talking about to support this thing, I think next year is going to be pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, I think that one of the key things, I'm guessing that in your sort of view of the ABS unemployment, I'm guessing that you're thinking it's in all likelihood we're going to see a relatively large drop in the participation rate in it for over the long term.
Correct. For that very reason, you know, the 55 pluses and some of the younger people as well. And interestingly, I've had a few people say to me they're thinking of actually leaving Australia.
Really?
Yep. To which I replied, are you sure? You know, where are you going to go? Because at the moment, I would say that Australia is relatively more attractive than many other, you know, certainly sort of Western countries. Though in some cases, they're talking about other parts of Asia.
Well, to be completely honest with you, I mean, like looking at the cost of living in some of the around Australia, you know, the fact that mortgage rates, so you can now get a mortgage with a one in front of it, you know, from even the big banks here these days. I mean, realistically, if you can manage to renegotiate your mortgage down to 1.98% or whatever it is like for over a 4-year period, to be completely honest with you, in outside of Melbourne and Sydney and some of the more affluent suburbs, you could probably just about get by on JobKeeper. If you tighten your belt, the missus and the husband both on JobKeeper, you can get by on JobKeeper. You tighten your belt, you know, you buy home brand, you get rid of the second car, you can get by. It's doable. I mean, a lot of people don't want to do that, but it'd be doable. I mean, I suppose in that particular way, Australia's looking pretty good.
I'm waiting for your next book, Tarek, on how to get by on JobKeeper. I can just see it now.
Well, you, the key, and this comes from someone who did used to live the 2-minute noodle life for quite some time when I was younger. The key is working out exactly how much a meal costs.
Yep.
Once you realize that, and you go, oh, okay, if I buy that box of cereal on special, I can get 7 meals out of that. Each one only costs me 26 cents. You know, it's doable.
Well, I mean, you know, we laugh about this, but there are many people, of course, doing that all the time.
Oh, and I was laughing about it, but yeah. I'm also being serious.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's, and there are a number of people who literally are hand to mouth. I reckon that about a quarter of households have less than 1 month's savings to cover all of their living costs. Right? I mean, that's a serious situation. And, of course, the fact of the matter is that healthy food is often more expensive than cheap food. So you actually end up with a less good diet and all those things. I mean, these are really big social issues. And I wonder whether we've lost the plot a little bit in terms of thinking about, you know, what society is for and how we help society to develop. And, you know, the universal basic income philosophy, you know, does actually, to my mind, if you're going to start throwing stimulus around the place, should be on the agenda, I think.
I think it's a part of a long list of things that realistically should be considered. I mean, to be completely honest with you, even an adequate safety net, to me, that somehow finds a way to cover the cost. The key to me, the biggest problem, aside from the fact that the Centrelink system is very, very difficult to navigate, it's very difficult to qualify in some cases, and it can be very challenging to deal with because basically it's designed to be that way. And that's actually what I've heard from people who work at Centrelink. I won't give any clues as to who they are because they'll get in trouble. But that's just the way things are. And I'm not sure if a UBI is necessary if you have the right safety nets and the right things in place, because I mean with borrowing rates as low as they are, we could house the homeless, we could house everyone on the social housing list, we could probably even supply subsidized housing to people under X income, and we could get everyone into a house, we could do all, you know, everyone, you know, house everyone that we needed to. And with rates so low, and as long as people pay their own way, we could get by. You know, we could make it. I think we could make it work. I mean, I can't say that I've, you know, done a big 74-page academic study where I've done, you know, dotted every I and crossed every T. But you know, bar napkin math, it's doable. But by the same token, we don't really want a fully housed populace, because if we had a fully housed populace, where's the impetus to go out there and bid up housing prices?
Well, and that's really the point. And I guess the point, maybe as we sort of come to the end of this conversation, there are choices that are being made, in, you know, implicitly or explicitly, but there are also other choices that could be made And I sometimes wonder whether, in fact, you know, the full range of options that should be being talked about and thought about are being talked about. I mean, Treasury is myopic in terms of the way that it thinks about it. Certainly the government is. And I'd argue that the states are too. So maybe there is a need to stand back and think a bit harder about what's really important, what's society about, and what are the right mechanisms we need in place. And I guess the other point to make is it's always hard. You know, the analogy I sometimes use in, you know, we're in a plane and we're trying to sort of swap the engines out as we go. It's always a bit tough to sort of keep the plane in the air. But the fact of the matter is, sometimes it will be good to stand back and ask the question about where are we flying to?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think the problem at the moment is you're looking purely, you know, look from like a real politic perspective, things are working well for the government. You know, I mean, they're extremely popular. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if we see JobKeeper extended another 6 months because, you know, and have it become, a, you know, election buyer and, you know.
Trademark.
Yeah, exactly. You know, maybe I should get some black mugs from that and sell them to the Liberal Party. But it's just, you know, they're very successful. You know, people love them. They believe that they've saved them. That, you know, that nothing else bad is going to come to pass, and that they're going to continue to provide this fantastic safety net, and that's really incentivized the government to not do anything imaginative, really whatsoever, beyond the initial crisis response. Yep. You know, you look at the budget, and it's just like, what's there to really drive a better version of Australia? Now, I know that people have a very, very different view of what a better Australia may be, whether it's cutting red tape or social housing or whatever, but there needs to be some vision, regardless of whether you come at it from a left perspective, centre perspective, or right perspective.
Yeah, exactly. I sometimes say, do something, anything, right? Rather than just sort of, you know, continuing to spiral around the same vortex again and again and again, expecting something different to actually come out of the back of it. It won't. It'll just go on the same way. So, well, you know, always interesting talking with you, Tarek. And I have to say that, you know, we are in complex and difficult times for many people. I'm not sure that things are going to sort of shake out. But I think it's sometimes important to stand back and just try and ask some of those bigger questions. So we'll do some more of that next time we chat, huh?
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, mate.